good. Good afternoon. So last time we started out by finishing up talking about monitors, so which we saw were a general tool for corrugating different threads. We looked at some examples of how to do that. And we also talked briefly about transactions, kind of another kind of interface that's much higher level than monitors. So you have one example of this kind of general tool you can use to do whatever thread coordination you want. We had this other system where you said, I just care about these things happening independently-ish and let someone else implement the details, which transactions was. And then we started talking about building up network functionality. And we had this notion of layers, which we're going to go into more detail about sort of what individual layers do today. But basically, we were going to build that connection type functionality that you saw in CSO1 in the sockets chat lab from sort of simpler sets of functionality. And we had these layers that I showed you, four of them, based on kind of the conventional way that the sort of modern internet happens to be built. And each of these layers was implemented by basically calling to the lower one until we got down to like actually sending bits on wires or bits over the radio and so on. And we looked at kind of the third layer in our picture, the transport layer, which was going to be implementing these reliable streams on top of unreliable transitive messages in what we term this mailbox model, that we can send messages that are kind of like letters that are delivered independently that sometimes get lost. And we want to build just a stream of data, like that kind of remote terminal you can talk to that you saw with using TCP sockets last in CSO1. And we saw we had these kind of two big tools to do that. So one was that we had acknowledgments. We need to know, did the message actually get there or not? And we needed to handle, if it didn't, dealing with that. So we combined acknowledgments with this notion of a timeout, that we wait for an acknowledgment. If we didn't get one after a certain amount of time, we'd send the thing again. And we had sequence numbers because, well, we couldn't send everything in one single message. So we'd have to mark which part is which. So if they're received out of order or duplicated, we can figure out what happened and reconstruct that single stream of data. So then we started talking about some things that we need to do to actually get our messages to the right place. It's going to be sort of one of our first big thing, probably our biggest topic today. We started talking about names versus addresses. So names versus addresses is a concept we've seen before. We've seen it with kind of things in memory, that we have things in memory which have a name, like you have a variable called counter. And when we're writing assembly or the machine code that the assembly produces, we don't actually have counter in that machine code. That's not what the processor understands. The processor wants an address, which is an easier way for it to find that information. And we have the same concept in networks, that we have names for machines or programs on machines, but that's not actually the form the underlying network layers want to use to actually get stuff to that machine or the right program on the machine. Some questions about things we covered last time. Okay, so I'll mention briefly, so we remember assignments. So there should be, I believe there's a TLB assignment due this Friday, which is you're implementing something that could work with your page table solution, but you're not going to write it with your page table solution. You're writing it with your sort of dedicated testing code instead. But basically the idea is, well, your page table solution does a page table lookup. We'd like to cache that like a TLB would. You're going to simulate that cache. We have a lab this week which is using something called OpenMP. So OpenMP is a higher level toolkit for coordinating things with multiple threads. And it's focused specifically on cases where you want to do things in parallel. So you're going to use that a bit in the lab. And then we're going to have an assignment, which is called Life, because we're implementing sort of a simulation thing called Conway's Game of Life that you're going to do without OpenMP. You're going to do it with the low barriers that we learned about earlier. You'll probably see that, gosh, OpenMP would make it simpler, and that's true. You're not allowed to use OpenMP on this. So. So you can get some ideas about maybe strategies for that assignment from the OpenMP lab kind of by accident. I had on a street bike asking, what's this thing I have around my neck? This is an audio recorder because I don't like using the computer mic, even though I am using it, but as a backup. Okay, so last time we finished up on sort of these names and addresses, and we're going to talk about sort of examples of what's going on. We're going to look at, starting with the link layer, what gets sent. In this class, we're not going to talk much about the physical layer, but we need some way of actually sending bits across wires or radios. That's more of an electrical engineering topic. But assuming we can send bits, what sort of our messages that we're sending going to look like? And we mentioned we had this terminology that we call these messages frames. And those frames are going to be used to send packets, the network level messages, which are going to be used to send segments or datagrams, the transport level messages, which are going to be used to send whatever the application layer cares about. And I'll give you an example here of what would be sent in an Ethernet frame. So this is a message for Ethernet. Ethernet is probably most commonly encountered as the way you physically plug in a computer to the network. Most commonly in a consumer context. And the Ethernet frame is pretty simple as far as what it contains. It has a destination address, a source address to say where it came from, and some type information. I believe that it is the indicator for IP, which is our most common network layer, and the actual data. And I label these addresses as MAC addresses. So MAC stands for Media Access Control. And these addresses are commonly what we'll see used at the link layer. And they are unique numbers that identify a specific piece of hardware, basically. So if I have a desktop computer with two Ethernet ports and Wi-Fi, it's probably going to have three MAC addresses for each of those two ports and the Wi-Fi. So it identifies a particular sort of way of accessing the network for a computer. Yeah? Question, does the order matter? So it matters in the sense that someone needs to decide on an order because we're just going to get these bits and they're not going to be labeled. So we need to decide in the order, and they just decided arbitrarily, oh, destination comes first. Other questions? So we have this thing that's going to be sent over a physical cable connected to my computer to some other machine that is sort of conceptually also connected to that cable, or possibly actually connected to that cable. We'll get into that bit, but it's on the same kind of wired network. And we have a bunch of data, and this data is usually going to contain something for the next layer up that's using the link layer to implement some functionality. And the next layer up was our network layer, the thing that handles getting data sort of to the right machine, possibly like across the country. And the most commonly used version of that is IP for Internet Protocol. So the data in the link layer is actually the packet for the Internet Protocol, and that contains its own kind of information. It contains a version number, it has a length, it has a protocol information which says what type of datagram or segment is located inside this. And it has its own source and destination address. So I have to say, wait a moment, why do we have two different addresses here? And well, it's because they're for different purposes. So these addresses here say on the local network, on that wire we're connected to, what machines care about this message, care about this frame. But the addresses here say, you know, between all our networks, at the network layer where we're sending this across the world potentially, what machines are involved. And those could be different machines. Yes? Question, what are the unhighlighted bytes? They are other fields in the header that I don't think are important enough to talk about. If we take a networking class, we'll probably look at the full description. And you can look it up if you want to. But they mostly aren't relevant to our discussion, even though, yes, they are important. Yeah?
Why do we have less bytes to designate IP address than MAC address? Because it feels like there are more network connections.
So the question is, why are our MAC addresses shorter than our IP addresses? That is mostly a history issue. And you might say, and you're saying correctly, that that seems like a mistake, because don't we want to have a lot of IP addresses, and that isn't so many? That is a reasonable argument, and you know, this is IP version 4. Version 6, which we'll mention briefly, fixes this problem by making them 128 bits instead of 32. Unfortunately, not everyone uses that, so I'm showing you what's still most common today. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we have this IP packet that's going to somehow get to the right machine, possibly being sent on other networks too. And its data is going to be for the next layer up, which is our transport layer that handles that reliability. So in this case, that protocol number happens to correspond to TCP. So this is a TCP segment. And it has its own addresses that are going to be for identifying the right program on the source machine and the destination machine. Because if I have a web browser connected to a web server, I can open up multiple copies of that connecting to the same web server, and we have to distinguish those. Somehow, these are going to be how we're going to do that. And we also have our sequence number. We have some metadata and some more metadata I haven't highlighted. And the actual information that's going to be for our application layer. So like if it's my web browser communicating with the web server, like saying what page am I getting or what's the page's data or something else that's kind of meaningful to the program we're running. Questions so far? Okay, so one issue I kind of glossed over was at our sort of link layer, I said we had a source and destination, and that might seem kind of silly in the context of a wire, because if I have a cable connected from one machine to another, it seems like, why do we just specify that? It's either that machine or that machine. So, there's a couple reasons why it doesn't work out quite the same way. So the link layer includes lots of different things. So Ethernet, Wi-Fi, and DOCSIS, and they generally kind of usually have this source destination concept. And in some cases, we have a physical wire or a radio medium that really is shared between multiple machines very directly. So in the case of cable modem, that's kind of obvious how that happens, that the cable turns out that we're all accessing kind of the same set of stuff that's shared with other people that are nearby on the network. And with Wi-Fi, it's the same sort of radio space. And historically, with Ethernet, this actually was the case, that we'd have multiple, like more than two machines that had wires that were physically, electrically connected to each other. This is not how Ethernet works today, but we can use these protocols to contact machines on what I'll call the same network segment. And what that means kind of varies, because you can configure things differently, but often all the machines connected to a single sort of switch or router will be able to communicate via the link layer, you know, even though they're not like electrically connected, the switcher router will forward things as if they're kind of connected directly, like just similar to simulating as if they were on the same Wi-Fi. So they'll be able to send things directly to and from each other. And in the link layer, typically all these protocols use MAC addresses. That's kind of just a standard for you have some sort of network device that needs to specify who it is. And these are assigned by the manufacturer, usually. They don't have to be, but usually they're assigned by the manufacturer, kind of hard-coded in the device. So when you buy a machine or a Wi-Fi card or something, it will have a MAC address or potentially multiple MAC addresses kind of built into it. And another thing that can comes up with the link layer is that usually we can specify, instead of a destination address of a particular machine, we can specify anyone. We can specify everyone who's connected to the same network. And this is commonly called broadcast. Okay. So questions about sort of what our link layer does and this idea that the network segment isn't the same quite as the wire, but it's basically the same network you communicate with the link layer. Okay, so our link layer is going to handle dividing our raw bits into messages somehow and identifying who they're from when we have a shared radio or wire or sort of virtual wire, handling things like, what if I have a shared radio and two machines try to transmit at the same time? The link layer is going to deal with that type of conflict. And sometimes the link layer will handle dropping or resending messages if there's corruption. Doesn't have to, because we learned that the transport layer is going to, you know, be able to handle that if it needs to. But sometimes it does this. This is, I think, more common when we're using radio because, you know, Wi-Fi is less reliable than a physical wire, so you want that more for Wi-Fi. So then we have the network layer. So we have this link layer that handles things on the local network, and the network layer, you know, since it has that functionality of the link layer, it doesn't worry about how do I send bits across a wire or across the radio. It just worries about how do I bridge networks together. And kind of the most common version of this that you'll see today is the Internet Protocol version 4 or version 6. There are some other network layers that are in use, but these are the ones that you're going to see these days. And Internet, well, it comes from internetwork. These are for bridging multiple networks together. And we have these addresses, which are going to actually play an important part in making this protocol sort of work. So I'm going to talk about what addresses for starting first IP version 4 look like. So they're 32-bit integers. And typically, you'll see them written in this dotted quad form, as it's called. So called because these are, it's a quad as in 4 bytes, and dotted sort of separating each of the bytes, just as decimal pieces. But over the wire, this is just sent as a big number. But we just have this way of writing the addresses down that's more readable and will actually correspond to how the addresses are allocated in the real world. So we have all these addresses, and these are used on the internet, so they kind of, a lot of these have to be, you know, sort of globally unique. And the way that's done is that we centrally assign organizations blocks of addresses. So for example, UVA has all the addresses from 128.148.0.0 to 128.143.0.0 to 128.143.255.255, which is 64,000-ish addresses. And Google has, at least as of the time I wrote this slide, these three ranges of addresses. And by had these addresses, I mean, so they've been assigned those addresses and they can configure machines to have those addresses. And because they're assigned to UVA, we know that, you know, things for those addresses are meant to go to UVA's networks, for example. There are also some addresses that are reserved for non-internet use, which you are likely to have seen on networks which are not as directly connected, as we'll talk about later, to the real internet. This includes everything starting with 127 or 10 or 192.168. We'll talk a little more about that later. There's something called network address translation that complicates things. But we're going to do the simple version first, where we assign organizations these blocks of addresses. And I mentioned this is IP version 4, and version 6 is already in use. And version 4 has this problem that our addresses are 32-bit numbers, so we can only support 4 billion devices. And it turns out that we can support less than 4 billion things because of how the addresses work. It's actually a lot less, as we'll see when we talk about why the addresses are assigned in these big blocks later. So IPv6 is quite old, but has gotten adopted very, very slowly. And it's basically IP version 4, but with 128-bit numbers instead of 32-bit ones. And they're written differently because they decided maybe I shouldn't write 16 decimal numbers next to each other. That's kind of inconvenient. So it's written in generally in hexadecimal, with 16-bit parts surrounded by colons and double colons to represent a bunch of zeros, which is not that uncommon. And I mentioned IPv4 has some special addresses that aren't used on the real internet. IPv6 also has some of these. So all zeros and one is a special address for the current machine you're on. And anything starting with FB80 is what's called a link local address. It only works in your local network. And if you have a machine that doesn't actually have IPv6 internet connectivity, often you'll see it has these addresses, but those aren't real internet addresses. So I mentioned these addresses are signing these big blocks. Why is that useful? Well, that's because we need to figure out how to get information to the correct network. And if we looked at our packet, we had the destination address. So we need some machine to look at that address and figure out where things go. And by having things in big blocks, we can have a table that says, oh, this range of addresses goes to this network, and so on. And because they're assigning these big blocks, even for very large internet service providers who have lots and lots of networks they're connected to, this is a tractable problem. I'm not saying it's a great problem. I'm not sure what current numbers are, but what I've heard historically is that for the very big internet service providers, you need like maybe 300,000 entries, which is tractable. Versus if we like had an entry for each of like the billion machines connected to the internet, obviously that wouldn't work very well. So we can have an entry for each of these ranges saying where to send it to, and basically we have these machines we call routers that are gonna receive messages from the networks they're connected to. They're gonna look at the packets they get and say, okay, where does this need to go? And then they're going to copy the packet to the network that is interested in it, that has the destination machine or is connected closer to the destination machine. And if you take a networking course, they'll probably discuss how the heck do we make this table? That's not a topic we're going to talk about in this class, but it's not trivial, obviously, especially when it contains, you know, hundreds of thousands of entries. So questions on this router idea? Yeah. question, will there be multiple layers of routers? So in the sense that, you know, this network might be connected to another router that's connected to other networks, and that might be how we expect the message to get there. That's going to be very common, right? You're not, you know, if you're sending, connecting to a website in Japan, you know, your ISP is probably doesn't have anything in Japan, and probably often their ISP might even not even have, be connected to that network. So you'll have to go through several sort of different networks on the way. And kind of at each of these steps, we will kind of forward, we'll take a packet in, and we'll send a copy of that packet in a new frame on each network. And I guess if you look at what happens on the real internet, commonly, like, if you're going, especially like around the world, you know, it might be like 10, 20 hops, 10, 20 routers in the middle. Yeah?
And it would always be like a router, network, repetition instead of router, and then network.
Question, always be a router, network, repetition instead of router. So I'm using the term network very vaguely. The way this network could work, this could be a network that only two things are connected to. We'd still consider that a network. So it could be a router connected directly to another router, and that probably is actually a common case in practice, but it would appear the same. But I'm sort of abstracting that because, like, the network would have multiple things connected to it, potentially. Does that answer your question? But we could have, yeah, the sort of trivial network that there's two things connected to is very possible. And I guess also something I'm not showing is it might see, say, you know, this table here might actually say where to send it to on the other network. Probably will say that. Yeah?
I actually had a question about IP 6 addresses.
Yeah. So the question is, how do we know how much the double colons represent in zeros? I believe you're only allowed to have one set of double colons, and the addresses are always 128 bits in total, so you can work out from that. Yeah. Other questions? Our network layer works by we sort of build these tables of how to forward messages to the right place so they get closer to where they need to go. We also usually have kind of a default, and if you aren't running a giant ISP, usually if you have a router, its table will not be like super long. It will basically have like one or two entries and the default. But if you're running a big ISP, you know, that's won't be the case. Yeah?
How are they allocating who gets what IP address? Like, you have to pay for it?
How do you allocate who gets what IP address? Do you have to pay for it? Sort of. So there's a nonprofit known as the Internet Assigned Names and Numbers Corporation. IANA is the abbreviation. That's responsible for distributing, among other things, IP addresses, both IPv4 and IPv6. And they... So in the old days of the internet, they were kind of allocated to the early players in the internet. And so for some that reason, some of them have surprisingly large blocks of IP addresses that compared to their size. Some, like, you know, UCs, for example, University of California campuses. But these days, they're under IANA, there are some smaller sort of, there's an organization for Europe called RIPE, which distributes IP addresses in Europe. There's an organization for Asia Pacific, APNIC, Asia Pacific Network Information Center, I think. And there's a similar organization for America called ARIN, and one for AFRINIC for Africa, and LACNIC for Latin America. and they distribute it to ISPs in their area. I think the theory is that you could get things if you just demonstrate a need. In practice, there's also trading of these blocks of IP addresses, especially from organizations who, for historical reasons, have a lot and don't need them all anymore, especially for IPv4. For IPv6, there's a lot more addresses, so it's a lot less contentious. I think there's some sort of small registration fees, but like they're trivial compared to, you know, the cost of running an ISP. But if you're getting IP addresses, IPv4 addresses from someone who doesn't need them, I gather those costs are like are pretty substantial, like tens of dollars an address these days. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. And, oh, I mentioned that there were some special IP addresses, so I'll mention some. So the 127 addresses, all of them, everything starting with 127, is reserved to represent local hosts. So often we want to somehow do something with the current machine, so there's a special address to represent the current machine, known as localhost if you're writing out the name. So that's the name of it. Sometimes also known as a loopback, because it just gets back to the current machine. And when they were designing IP version 4, they just reserved 16 million of those. Which, well, IPv6 didn't do that, probably telling. There's also addresses that are kind of, that are so-called private, that are not intended to be used on the real internet, that exist so you can use them on local networks. And if you look at addresses assigned to machines you are using, often they will be these addresses, which means that when you're contacting the internet, somehow those addresses aren't used. We'll talk about that later. And there's also some addresses you might see if you look at the configuration of your machine, which are called link local addresses. So these are addresses that can only be used on the local network. So like, you know, if your machine's connected via Wi-Fi, it would only be valid on that Wi-Fi network, not even another Wi-Fi network, say at UVA. And these start with 169.254. I'm mentioning these mainly because I don't want you to think, oh, that's my real IP address that works on the internet. Probably not. Okay, so we have our network layer that sort of forwards messages to the right place. We learned that we need to have an address to identify the machine to go to. But we have some other responsibility that's in this transport layer we haven't talked about, which is reaching the correct program. So we, the network layer, we now know how, even if we're going across the world, how we reach the correct machine. We sort of go through these routers that have these tables of where to forward to get closer and closer. In the transport layer, we have to reach the correct program somehow when there's multiple programs on the machine. And you saw in my example here, we had these port numbers that are going to be responsible for telling what program a message and the transport layer comes from or is going to. So what are port numbers? So these, as used on the internet, are going to be 16-bit numbers. You saw that we had 16 bits for them. That's just the size that was chosen. It's generally been sufficient. And these identify basically a program on the machine. You can kind of think of it as, you know, if we're thinking of our mailbox analogy, it's like having one address with multiple PO boxes. So the machine is going to get a message. It's going to have a port number. It's going to use that to forward it to the correct program on that machine. And port numbers have some conventions about how they're allocated. Generally, the lower port numbers are reserved for specific services. So if you're running a web server, for example, it's going to run on port 80 and or 443 because we've just decided that those are the port numbers we expect web servers on. And if you're running an SSH server, it's just going to run on port 22 because we've decided those are what we expect an SSH server to be on by default. And generally, all the load number port numbers are used in this way, where we will assign them to specific services. So someone who wants to connect to my machine doesn't need to know the port number. They just need to know I'm connecting for SSH. Therefore, I use port 22 if no one tells me anything else. We also have a bunch of port numbers. The higher ones are often allocated on demand. So if I have my web browser running and I'm connected to a web server, let's say I have like five different tabs connecting to that web server. Well, we need to have a separate destination for all the things we're sending there. And we need to assign port numbers so we know how to get it back to the correct tab of my web browser. And so we need to make up new port numbers as we're running programs. The higher number of port numbers are going to be used for that. So when you did your sockets lab and you were connecting to a server, you probably connected to a specific port number, but you needed to do that connection, you'd have a port number you're connecting from. And you actually don't need to specify that. The OS will make one up for you. And we need to do that because when we're sending things back to you, they need to have some place to go. Questions? Yes.
If I'm connecting to two websites, right, like Google and then YouTube, does it differentiate on a software level, what goes to the Google page and what goes to the YouTube page?
Question: if you're connected to two different web servers and you're getting data back, does it differentiate on a software level what goes to which? So, if you remember the CSO1, you made a socket, and if you're connected to two things, you make two sockets. So in that case, the OS, which is implementing those sockets for you, yes, is responsible for assigning the data to the correct socket. And it's going to do this by looking at the combination of the IP addresses and port numbers involved. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so when you did transport layers before, you typically used TCP, I probably should mention UDP at this point in time. So TCP gave us reliable transmission with a connection. And you might also see programs use UDP. So UDP gives us unreliable transmission, but it's still a transport layer thing. So when I said here the transport layer implements kind of reliability in streams, well, it implements that for programs that want it. Some programs don't want that. They don't care about those features. They just want the mailbox model, but we can't expose the network layer to them directly because the network layer doesn't implement this functionality of reaching the right program, right? It just reaches the whole machine. So UDP is a way of getting that functionality. So UDP has port numbers. It lets us identify a particular socket that the message goes to or comes from, but it doesn't implement all that stuff about reliability, doesn't have acknowledgments, it doesn't handle sort of splitting things up into smaller messages. If you try to send something on UDP and it's too big, it's just gonna say, nope, can't send that. Whereas with TCP, it's gonna sort of group messages together, split them up if needed, and so on. Yeah. I'll take you low, yes. Second or first, and then we'll go to fourth. Yeah. What's the point of using UDP? So if your program doesn't care about sort of combining the messages together, then UDP could be faster. So a classic example is, let's say you're streaming video, and you might want your program's policy to be that if the video is more than 2 seconds old, I don't want you to resend it. TCP doesn't let you really implement that policy. It's going to try to resend it anyways. UDP would let you actually implement that. That answer your question? And
what do UDP and TCP stand for?
TCP, I believe, is Transport Control Protocol. I think UDP is, it's something datagram protocol, I think.
User
datagram protocol, okay. So datagram, because the UDP messages are called datagram because it's not a stream of stuff. Yes, and these are, so there's other protocols that are like TCP and UDP. Those are the ones that you can use on the internet, but other types of networks have had other things that provide the same functionality. I guess another thing I'll mention with why programs might use UDP is with TCP, you have to connect to a specific server. With UDP, you can have a socket and you can send things to multiple different servers with one socket or receive things from multiple different places with one socket. That's another reason a program might want to use UDP over TCP. But I would say if you're writing network programs, you should start with TCP and only use UDP if you have a good reason to. Just because the OS probably does a better job of implementing all that reliability stuff than you do, and you probably want at least a little bit of it. Okay. So we've talked about a bit about how networks work. Let's do a little, here we have all our layers. So let's say I have A is connected to a network, and that network is connected to, has a router, that's also connected to another network that B is connected to. And let's assume we've already opened a TCP connection, so we have a socket that's already set up, and A sends 2,000 bytes to B, and it happens that that has to be split up into two different segments, because our network doesn't support actually sending that much at a time. At least one of the networks involved doesn't. So let's say we have to send 1,400 bytes and then 600 bytes. That would be a pretty common scenario on the internet. So how many frames are sent? So remember, frames are link layer things. We have two networks involved. How many frames across summing those two networks together?
Okay.
And including everything involved in sending these 2,000 bytes of data. Thank you. Okay, who likes some more time? Okay, so who thinks we should have at least two? Okay. At least three. At least four. At least five. At least six. At least seven. At least eight. At least 10. Okay, so we have a mix of answers. Most people say at least four. Some people are getting up us into the six or eight. So I think four is an easy minimum to get. And that's because our frames are, we have to send a new frame for each network, right? Because the frame we're sending here, this is gonna be, say, from A to router. We're gonna first send the first part of the data. Here we have a packet from A to B that's gonna be sent in that frame. So this is frame one. That contains the first 1400 bytes, also with a port number and some other things. And then we're also gonna send another copy of this with the next 600 bytes. And then, so that's one, two here, we're gonna have to forward that through the router. And when we do that, we need to make a new frame, and I'm gonna say it's definitely a new frame because it's gonna have a different source and destination. That we're gonna have a third message that's from the router to B, that is the packet from A to B with 1400 bytes. So it's the same packet, the same network layer message. We're just gonna copy it, but we need a new frame to contain it because it now has a new source and destination for that second hop. Because remember, the frame is only what's happening on the local network. The local network doesn't know, network two doesn't know anything about A, doesn't want to know about A. Its source needs to be something on that network. And with network one, A is gonna send to the router, not to B on that network, because on that network, it can't send to B directly, it has to go through the router. And the link layer only deals with our current network. So we'll have four. So just to send the data over, we're gonna have four messages, four frames, I should say, where we're gonna have two frames that are copies of the first 1400 bytes, but sent, first sent from A to router, then sent from router to B, then that same process for the next 600 bytes. Yes?
So you have to send each segment in a different frame, even though frames contain, so a frame can only contain one segment?
Question, so a frame can only contain one segment? So this is, I guess, where we get into things which hypothetically could vary with different link layers. But generally, the link layers that are used in practice, yes, we have to make a separate frame for each segment, for each packet. And that's how it's going to work. Conceptually, we could have a link layer that works differently for that, that lets us bundle messages together somehow. That is not common. Yes?
So if B acknowledges them, will it send two frames back as well, one for each packet?
So the question is, when B acknowledges them, will it send two frames back? Yes. So B is going to have to send an acknowledgement because that's TCP is reliable, right? We said that TCP handles the mailbox model that the network's giving it by sending acknowledgements. So that's going to give us at least two more frames because we're going to have to send back from B, we're gonna have to send back an acknowledgement, and that has to go through the router. And there's kind of two ways we can view that acknowledgement happening. So one thing B could do is B could somehow acknowledge both of these things at once, in which case we just have two more, or if it acknowledges them separately, we'd have four more. So I think the simplest answer is A, if you know more about how TCP works, you might know that it turns out TCP tries to avoid sending as many acknowledgments, so it actually will do the task of acknowledging multiple messages with one message if they're received fast enough. Yes?
So it doesn't know that that one is coming, it just has it will just wait anyways, and then when it times up, it'll go.
Question, it doesn't know that a new one is coming, it will just wait and send it. I'm not sure, there's different ways I've heard of it being implemented, but the simplest scheme would be that when you want to send an acknowledgement, you wait a little bit to see if a new message comes in, so you can acknowledge at least two messages at a time. Yeah. What is the maximum size of a segment? So that depends on the protocol. What typically happens on the internet is that IP, so the network protocol, sort of theoretically supports packets of about 64K, and that's because if we go back to our example here, we saw that this length field here is 2 bytes. So, and that's in bytes, so the maximum size we can support is 2^16. But there's a caveat there, which is that the link layers usually do not support that size. So usually link layers support a size of around 1,500 bytes per frame. And it turns out IP actually has a way of dividing one packet among multiple frames. But usually machines try really hard not to do that and instead try to set the segment size based on what the network seems to support between, in this case, machines A and B. And commonly, yes, we're another thing we're not going to test on. The way that is handled is that when setting up the connections, machines A and B will figure out what's the largest size they can send. And a way they can do that is by trying to send things and seeing what size, gets an error basically sent back saying this was too big. Yeah. Question, is the MAC address only for coordination purposes? So the MAC address, well, all the addresses are for coordination. The MAC addresses are going to be how we write the addresses here, right? All these addresses in our frames that aren't part of the packet that the frame contains are going to be MAC addresses. So when A is sending a message on the network and saying it's for the router, A is going to use the router's MAC address, not the router's IP address to do that. When is the IP address used? So the router uses the IP address, because the IP address is what specifies B, regardless of what network it's on. Right? So the MAC addresses are what we use when we're sending something across on the same network. That's how we identify the other things on the network. We're identifying things like potentially across the world, we always use IP addresses. And we can also use IP addresses on the local network, but in that case, we still need the MAC addresses to actually send things on the local network. So if I have two machines on the same Wi-Fi, I can connect to the other machine with its IP address, but when it's sent over the Wi-Fi, the Wi-Fi implementation doesn't know about IP addresses directly, so it's just going to see MAC addresses. Does that answer your question?
So there are actually another implied connection in network 1 and network 2.
Question, there's another implied connection between network 1 and network 2? I don't get what you're... When is the IP address used? It's used by the router. That's how the router knows how to forward the message it gets.
I thought the router would also be using the MAC address of B.
So the router will send with the MAC address of B, but it needs the IP address that A's given to figure out where to send, what network to send that on. And we haven't discussed an important issue you're getting at, which is that we somehow need to map IP addresses to MAC addresses. That is indeed a thing that needs to happen that I've glossed over, but that is going to be an important step. Other questions? Okay, so I would say like the best answer is probably 6 or 8, including, you could argue for higher, because if you know more about how some link layer protocols work, sometimes the link layer does acknowledgments in addition to the transport layer doing them. An example of this is for Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi often does acknowledgments just over the local network because they want to catch problems sooner, basically, than waiting for it to like not be received across the world. So we have our TCP and UDP sockets, and I told you conceptually we have sort of an address we're connecting from and to, which is an IP address because it could be anywhere in the world, and we have port numbers to identify the programs. And the OS basically keeps a giant table of all the sockets along with what's sometimes called a 5-tuple of the type of connection it is. Is it TCP or UDP or something else? The addresses and port numbers involved. And basically, whenever data comes in, it looks up in this table and figures out what program to send it to. And if you did the CSO1 lab, I think you used the bind function on the server side to set that address. You can also use that for any connection. If you don't call it, the OS will make up a port number and choose an address for you. Most commonly this happens like if you're connecting to a server, you need an address and a port number to do that, the OS will make one up if it needs it, if you didn't supply one. And on Linux, the netstat command, and also some other OSs, can actually dump out this table. So this is the table on my desktop at some point in time. We have the local IP and port number and the remote IP and port number. And this corresponds to some socket for a particular program. So you can see the OS is actually tracking this whole table. We also have some other information here that's mostly boring. We have this receive and send queue size, which is 0. That's the amount of data which is ready to be either sent on the network or received via calling read on the socket, but hasn't gotten there yet. And we have the state of the connection, which you can see here is either established or this thing called time wait, which I'll get to in a bit. Yes? Can I repeat what those two zeros for receive queue and send queue? So receive queue is the amount of stuff that the OS has received but hasn't gotten to the application yet. For example, the application didn't call read, basically. And the send queue is the amount of stuff the OS got from the application but it hasn't sent on the network yet. Or finished sending on the network.
Not sent to what?
It hasn't finished sending it over the network. Receive queue is stuff that it's gotten from the network, but it hasn't sent given to the application yet. So this tool tracks that because, you know, if you're running out of memory, that could be a factor, and that's why it tells it for sysadministrators. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, I mentioned earlier that port 22 is for SSH. Does that mean that this first connection as listed, which goes to port 22, is probably me connecting to a remote server for SSH? Yes. And that means that this down here where data is coming from a local address of port 22 is probably some connection to an SSH server on this machine. So the question is, if my local address corresponds to port 22, does that mean I'm taking data and I am the server? So the port numbers don't actually tell us what the direction of flow is. And just because I connected to a server doesn't mean the information is only going in that direction. So the role of server versus client is just about who started it. It doesn't say what's going on after the connection is set up. And you probably saw that in CSO1 because, like, you know, even though someone had to connect, after it was connected, the code for the server client could basically be sort of swapped and nothing would change. Other questions? So this is sort of the table of things representing connections. If you remember the CSO1 lab, you also had a way of sort of accepting new connections. And those are also tracked kind of in the same table. We just use kind of special addresses to represent that we're waiting for connections instead of we have a particular machine we're talking to. And you can see these are in a state labeled as listen, meaning they're waiting for connections. So that's what that state means. So we can see, I guess here I don't have it listed, but we have a bunch of things that are running at particular addresses that are waiting to accept connections. Some of them are running at address the localhost address, so I can only connect to them from the current machine. Some of them are running at this special address of all zeros. That's a special address, which means any IP address works for that. It's called a wildcard address. So it's a shorthand for any IP address this machine has. And very commonly, machines will have multiple IP addresses. Even trivially here, I have, you know, if I'm connected to the Wi-Fi, I have probably two IP addresses, the one I have on the Wi-Fi and that 127.0.0.1 that I can use on my local machine to connect to things only on my local machine. And if I'm connected to like the Wi-Fi and a wired network, I probably have three. And if I have like a server with like three different Ethernet jacks, that probably has four, for example. Other questions? Yeah.
So once you make a new connection, it will update the foreign address, and then it will get moved to that other table you're talking about.
So question: once I get a new connection, it will update the foreign address and the local address of its wildcard and get moved to the other table. We'll make a new entry that sort of uses this as a template, is how I put it. So if you remember from the CSO1 lab, when you accept a connection, you still have a socket you can accept more connections on, hypothetically, even though you probably didn't. So they're both will be around after we accept a connection.
So will it stay in this table and just the state will be changed or listen to something else?
Will it stay in this table and the state will be changed? So it will stay in this table and if you're still able to accept more connections, probably the state will stay the same. If you like close it, then the state will change and it will eventually get out of this table. Yes?
So the port number would change for the wildcard ones if you're making a wildcard connection?
So the port number would change. So I would say, like, this is when we take in a connection, it's going to fill in the foreign address with something else. But the port number is going to be whatever they connected to still. Our local port number will be whatever they connected to. Okay, and I want to do a little bit about something you might notice here is what are all these time waits? And if you ever like run netstat or some similar command on a machine, you'll see tons of these time waits. You'll be like, what's going on there? So TCP has a state machine, which if you take a networking class, you'll learn about. We have a picture that's also in the reading. But basically, this tracks sort of what's the connection doing. And one of these states is known as time wait. And this is kind of confusing because this is a state connections are in when conceptually the connection is over, as far as you as a programmer are concerned. But the OS still tracks it, and the reason why is we want to deal with delayed messages. So if we have a delayed message, we want to ignore it. But the problem is, if I make a new connection, I could reuse the same port numbers. So the delayed message will look like it's part of a new connection, and I won't know what to do about that. So to avoid this, the time wait state kind of reserves the port number for long enough that we can make sure we handle any delayed messages before reusing it. And that's something the OS needs to deal with, even like after you've your program that uses sockets has exited. So that's on sort of connections, but we were all dealing with these addresses here and port numbers. And in some cases, we figured out the mapping from names to addresses, like we learned that SSH just uses 22. That's kind of just hard-coded in the SSH program, that it just uses 22. But we have to deal with these names to these addresses. How does that work? And the scheme we have for that on the internet is something known as DNS, or the domain name system. And the domain name system is a distributed database. So it's distributed, meaning there's lots of different machines running this one big database. And if I think of me connecting my laptop to a network, when I connect to the network, part of configuring that connection is going to be learning a DNS server typically run by my ISP, whatever network I'm connecting to. And when my web browser wants to, or some program I have wants to say, contact www.cs.virginia.edu, it needs to have an IP address to actually like open a connection to it. So we need to convert that name to an IP address. And it's going to contact this ISP's DNS server to do that. And if I'm connected to a random ISP, like if I'm on a trip across the country where they don't, aren't near Virginia, probably that ISP's DNS server won't know this. So how can it figure it out? Well, this ISP's DNS server is going to go to sort of a central server that is supposed to have all the data, known as a root DNS server. But of course, we don't actually have single servers that have all the IP addresses of everything on the internet. So it's going to go to this root server that's responsible for knowing everything, and it's not going to know everything, but it's going to say, well, I don't know that, but there's this server that's responsible for all the EDU addresses. Try them. So then the ISP's DNS server is going to contact a DNS server for the EDU addresses. And that server, well, it doesn't have all the EDU addresses. So it's going to say, well, I don't know where www.cs.virginia.edu is, but I know this server that knows about all the Virginia.edu addresses, why don't you contact that one? And the Virginia.edu server, well, it's not run by the CS department, so it doesn't know what a web server is, but it's going to say, I don't handle that. Contact the cs.virginia.edu DNS server. They'll know. And eventually, the ISP's DNS server will contact the cs.virginia.edu server, and it will get what's the actual IP address I want. Yeah?
So it kind of works backwards. It starts from the most general.
Question starts from the most general to the more specific one. It doesn't know? Basically, yes. Yeah?
So why are each of those DNS servers connected to like that ISP's DNS server instead of it being like the chain?
So the question is, why are the DNS servers not, so why when I contact the root DNS server doesn't it, go to the other ones for me? And I think this so I guess there's two reasons why. So one reason is that we're going to do caching in the ISP server, and it's going to be really helpful for it to know about all the steps. The other is that the root DNS server has a lot of traffic to deal with. And I should say the root DNS servers, there's like, depending on how you count, there's like 20 to like thousands of them. But they take a lot of traffic, and having them do less work is good. And so that's kind of a deliberate choice to like not overload those servers more than they are. But the big advantage will be that we'll see that we can do some caching that's going to limit how much actual queries we do. Yes?
Who manages the root DNS server?
So this is the root DNS servers. There's actually like, so there's 20 of them, 20 different sort of IP addresses of root DNS servers, and some of them are implemented by like a couple hundred machines or a couple thousand machines. And they're run by different organizations, I think all kind of under IANA in some way. Yes?
So is it always the case that we have a different server for every
Question, do we always need a different server for sort of each subdomain? No. So hypothetically, if the virginia.edu server was configured, it could answer the query directly, or even like the root server could hypothetically know the answer directly. The way we actually divide it up is probably based on kind of who's administering what, right? The root server people don't want to get updates all the time. They don't have the space for that. And like you can kind of be responsible for your own names this way, and that's the main advantage of this scheme. And by you, I mean, you know, if you're University of Virginia, you'll run the virginia.edu server, so you control everything that happens with it. You don't have to go through other people to make any names under virginia.edu work the way you want them to. Other strings? Yeah, so an optimization that the ISP's DNS server is going to do, as mentioned, is caching. And we can cache kind of each step of this process. So I showed us here asking the root server for www.csnvirginia.edu and saying, oh, I don't know that, but this is where .edu is. Our ISP's DNS server isn't going to just ask every time. It's going to remember, oh, it told me edu is here, and it's going to go directly to the .edu people the next time it sees a .edu name. It's not going to do that step over and over again. And we can kind of see what it gets back. So here I'm using a tool called Dig, which basically implements what the ISP server would be doing. And when I ask one of the root servers for virginia.edu, it says, oh, I don't know that, but here are the .edu DNS servers. There's actually a bunch to choose from. I can choose any one. And here are their IP addresses and IPv6 addresses. Contact one of them. I also have something here for helping with caching. So you see this time here. You might wonder, what's that number? That's the number of seconds this is valid for before I have to ask again. So the idea is I can remember .edu goes here for the next, that's probably about 2 weeks. I don't have to ask the root server again about .edu for the next 2 weeks. So we'll pick up on this next time, and hopefully also start talking a little about sort of secure channels.